We continue to learn more and more about the horrors that have existed within the walls of many New Jersey nursing homes over the past 2 years caused by the response to COVID-19 at those locations. New Jersey recently released a report detailing the worst of the worst nursing homes. Among those was, yes, that infamous nursing home in Andover, New Jersey, which, you might recall, received national attention for their stacking of bodies in a closet, some sort of makeshift morgue. Recent stories show that things are not changing for the better at that facility. Joining us to examine this situation is the Executive Director of the Long-Term Care Community Coalition, Richard Mollett. How are you today, Richard?
Hi, I'm well. Thanks so much for having me on.
And learn more about Long-Term Care Community Coalition, the services they provide, the help that they offer, the guidance they give, nursinghome411.org. We'll get you started on that. And as I said, Richard, you thought things couldn't get worse at the Andover facility, whatever. I mean, they changed the name from Andover Subacute to Woodland Behavioral Health. Rebranding doesn't really change much, though, does it? We have stories now of one of the residents ignored by a nurse and an aide for over an hour because when a catheter got stuck in a wheelchair. There have been at least two accounts that have been made public so far of failure to resuscitate patients who went into cardiac arrest. I mean, we know, and the report shows too, which, by the way, for you listening, you can go over to our download page and get the report. Woodland is among the worst of the worst. Why are the doors open, lights still on?
That's a great question. And frankly, I mean, I've been with my organization for 20 years, and, you know, just as you're laying out the facts here, it's still a really painful thing to think of, that people are in this facility. People have been accepted into this facility. It holds itself out as being a licensed nursing home, and the community has a right to expect that any licensed nursing home will be safe and providing at least basic care and services. And as I said, it's really painful to see these nursing homes that have, such as Woodland, that have persistent serious problems that frankly even predate the COVID pandemic.
And when I say Woodland's been rated the lowest among the worst for a long time, this goes straight through for the last 2 years. The rating system is a 1 through 5, 5 being the best, 1 being the worst. And Woodland has, or Andover Subacute, as the predecessor to being called Woodland, has been getting straight ones for the last 2 years. There's been no change. The violation reports have ranged from less than 10 pages to as many as 16 pages. So, again, well, first of all, I guess two questions is, why is it still open, and why are families still putting grandma and grandpa there?
Right. Well, I think just a, you know, quick answer to your second question is, as I kind of, you know, alluded to before, is people expect that a nursing home that's allowed to remain open, that's licensed by the state and the federal government, is going to provide decent care. And too often, families and residents don't have a lot of choice. You know, if you're being pushed out of a hospital, or if you're going from, you know, from a home situation or another situation, there's usually you have to move pretty quickly. And these facilities, you know, they make promises. I mean, that's what they do. That's legally what they do. They say when they accept anybody that they have the staff, they have the supplies, they have the expertise to provide the individualized care. That is the fundamental requirement of the federal nursing home reform law. I would say the problem, to get at your first question, is what I think of as a domino effect of failures, a failure by the nursing home to at least meet minimum standards of care and resident dignity and safety, and then a failure of the state to make sure that the nursing home is providing that care on a regular basis, and then a failure of the federal agency, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, to make sure the state is doing its job to ensure that residents are safe.
One of the problems is just the mere fact of trying to staff. On a good day, Woodland has maybe 50% of what's considered to be required staffing levels. And that's on a good day.
Right. And it's completely outrageous. Honestly, nursing homes, since the since the nursing home reform law, the federal law, went into effect in the early, over 30 years, required to have sufficient staff to meet the clinical and psychosocial needs of their residents, period, full stop. And there are a lot of regulations that are that lay out exactly how that's supposed to happen in terms of some of the things that you mentioned, responding to residents in a timely and professional manner, to be aware of residents' desires in terms of resuscitation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, the original story from during the pandemic was just appalling. But I would say just very quickly is, the part of the problem is, as I mentioned, a large part of the problem is, of course, that domino effect of failures by the licensed nursing home, by the state, and by the federal government. But also it's because we don't have a good safeguards in place to prevent owners like this from buying nursing homes and from keeping the nursing homes that they have. So it's essentially a free-for-all for the owners to do as little as they want and reap the profits.
Incredible. We're talking with Richard Mollin, who is the Executive Director of the Long-Term Care Community Coalition. Nursinghome411.org is their website, and you are listening to Issues and Ideas. We can get into the owners of Woodland, but that would take a whole episode of Issues and Ideas just for that because of all the indictments and the questionable practices they've perpetrated. But you mentioned, too, the federal and the state responsibilities. New Jersey does have... The position is called New Jersey Long-Term Care Ombudsman. Current holder of that position is a individual named Laurie Brewer. Has Ms. Brewer been engaged and helpful in any of this? Because if you go to the news section, for example, on the website for her office, the news release section, some basic means of communication to the public, that hasn't been updated for 2 years now.
That's interesting. So it's important to distinguish between what the Ombudsman Program does and what the New Jersey Department of Health does. So it's only the Department of Health that has regulatory authority over nursing homes. The Ombudsman Program, this is a federally mandated program under the Older Americans Act. Every state has an Ombudsman Program, but they operate within very specific parameters, and We could certainly talk about what they do, but in short, the Ombudsman programs do monitoring. They're generally the people who are in these nursing homes, and they work with residents and families to overcome challenges. But again, they don't have the regulatory authority. They can't pull a license. They can't penalize a facility. They can't bring in someone, as I think New Jersey Department of Health has now done, to monitor how the facility is being run. That's not within the purview of the Ombudsman program.
Look, it can stay with the state, too. I actually heard one of the spokespeople for the Murphy administration say, I'm paraphrasing here, that, nursing homes did not have to accept seniors with COVID-19 who were being kicked out of their hospital beds at the start of the pandemic. Did they not read the directive from Murphy's office 2 years ago?
Well, that's really interesting. I think that there is a little bit of misunderstanding about that. And, of course, we saw that in New York. We saw that in New Jersey. I think there might be a couple other states that did something similar. So the nursing homes are always obligated, always, no matter what the situation is, to only accept and only retain residents for whom they have enough staff, for whom they have the sufficient professional expertise, and for whom they have enough supplies to meet their clinical, their dignity, and their psychosocial needs, period, and full stop. So even if we had a directive from a governor to accept residents or accept people with COVID, or to try to make some accommodation for what's going on with the pandemic, especially in an early part of the pandemic, that never ever obligated the requirements of the facilities to, again, only accept and only retain. And it's a fundamental protection of the federal rules, but it's also the one that is, unfortunately, most often flouted. And that's why you have these horrific situations, both at Andover and at Woodland, and that, you know, other facilities, and not just the 15 that the comptroller identified, but many others. That's, you know, 15, the bottom 15, you know, you're talking about, you know, I guess the bottom of the barrel is, you know, how we're looking at it. But there are a lot of facilities across the state that are underperforming, to put it nicely.
And we saw the result of that, too. The families of patients who died at the New Jersey Veterans Centers, there was a collective almost $53 million settlement that the state offered. They're not being exactly transparent about the housing mechanics of the settlement, but nevertheless, the families have been given financial restitution. You think that's just the beginning, that we're going to see that more and more in New Jersey and even in New York State?
Well, part of the problem with that is that I don't remember if New Jersey was one of these states. I think that it was, but just to be careful, but many states, including New York, they gave facilities immunity for a lot of the poor care that happened.
Yeah, it was New Jersey.
The pandemic.
New Jersey,
and,
indeed.
I thought it was, but I wanted, of course, to be careful and precise about what I say. So that was really troubling, because it's really hard to, frankly, to make a case in these situations. It's hard for families. I mean, I've been a family member of nursing home residents in New Jersey, and I've seen both good care and poor care over the years. But, you know, when there's poor care, families don't want to dwell on it. A typical family doesn't want to think about their loved one having suffered unnecessarily. They don't want to spend more time in thinking about this and going to court. It's very rare that people actually do it, but it is something that we support, because in the absence of that strong oversight that we've been talking about, oftentimes the only thing that really pinches a provider who's just looking at his or her profits is to have a meaningful lawsuit or settlement. So we are, you know, we need to find the accountability where we can.
And maybe the answer is going to be, too, because Woodland, among the worst of the worst on that 15 in that state report, Woodland either gets the most or the second most amount of Medicaid money, $14 million a year. So there's a lot of money involved with the two. I just want to give a little about a minute left here. As far as your organization, Long-Term Care Community Coalition, what's your mission statement and goals, and how are you serving the people, the residents, and their families?
Oh, thanks for asking. So we're dedicated entirely to improving care and quality of life for residents in nursing homes and assisted living and other residential care settings. We are, unfortunately, don't have the capacity to provide individual help, but we have a lot of resources on our website. We have a learning center for families and residents and those who work with them, with fact sheets on residents' rights. So when people face some of these issues, they can look and they can easily understand what their rights are as a resident and advocate for them. And sometimes that's, you know, within a facility, but it could also be, you know, calling up your legislator. It could be, you know, calling up the Department of Health to file a complaint. The Medicaid Fraud Control Unit in the Attorney General's office is really important. They have a complaint hotline that we urge people to use as well. So we have a lot of resources. Again, we don't provide, we're a small organization, and we're not able to provide individual services, but we, you know, work with, you know, and we help, try to help and educate ombudsmen and others who do work with residents and families.
And as we all know, information education is indeed personal empowerment. I want to mention, too, because Mr. Mala, legislature, bipartisan bill SR-48 has been introduced. Hopefully it will pass quickly, too. We'll create a special 7-member committee with subpoena powers to probe what's been happening at the long-term care facilities throughout the COVID pandemic. And it won't be all Democrats, because you might be thinking, since the legislature is democratically controlled, the bill specifies no more than 4 people from one party, any one party, can serve on that committee. So keep an eye on that. We'll certainly keep you informed as well. Get some of the information that Richard was talking about, because, as I said, that is your empowerment key, nursinghome411.org website for the Long-Term Care Community Coalition. We've been joined by their executive director, Richard Mollett. Richard, thanks so much for the work you do, the awareness you're raising, for being here today.
Chris, thank you very much for having me, and you have a nice afternoon.